Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What? Albany? Dysfunctional?
This makes government work for the people. This is a budget that's not about the special interests. It's not about the lobbyists. It actually performs for the people of this state.
This is a sobering budget, unquestionably. Government had to tighten its belt with the same sense of urgency that working families have been tightening their belts.
The priorities for the Senate Republican Conference has been to cut government spending. That's been the priority of the people of the state of New York, to cut taxes, priority of the people of the state of New York, and really to empower the private sector.
Albany, dysfunctional? Not anymore, if you judge it by an on-time budget. Like Governor Cuomo, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, and State Senate Majority Leader Dean Scalos all did there in those clips. But maybe yes, for those who think the rich are not being asked for their fair share, still getting a previously scheduled income tax cut in this budget, while education and health care get slashed by billions to close the $10 billion deficit. So what have the three men in a room wrought for education, for the business climate? Will the Liberal Assembly actually vote for these cuts? What fights are yet to come, as there are reportedly some things still unresolved, including New York City versus suburban school aid cuts? And did the healthcare industry get rolled by endorsing the Medicaid reforms and then not getting the malpractice reform that they thought they were bargaining for? Liz Benjamin is with us, Daily News columnist and statewide political show host on YNN-TV in Albany. And Greg David is with us, Crane's New York business columnist and director of the Business and Economics Reporting Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Hi, Liz. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Hello, Brian.
Liz, let me start on a pure politics question, because everybody's only talking about this three-men-in-a-room agreement so far, for the most part. Most of the liberal downstate-dominated assembly wanted the millionaire's tax to not completely expire and felt strongly about it. Is it automatic that Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver has the votes to pass this budget in the assembly?
Well, actually, I don't think that the millionaire's tax is as big an issue as the rent control piece, which is not in the budget and was hugely important to certain segments of the downstate-dominated Democratic majority. And, you know, I've also spoken to some folks in the Senate conference who say that they might have a hard time voting for a budget that does not include the extension and or strengthening of rent control, and this budget does not. So I think that, look, Shelley Silver has 99 members of his conference. There are 51 members in the Republican conference. I think that they are going to get there. Will there be some no votes? I believe that there probably will be. It would be there will be votes of protest. On the other side, however, you have an issue where you've got 32 Republicans, four breakaway, quote-unquote, independent Democrats who have been voting with the Republicans, and then 26 Democrats. You'll see some no votes there, too. You know, the question was briefly broached of a quorum, but I don't think that they're going to, you know, pull a flyer like they did in Wisconsin. There will be no votes in protest on this budget. I think it's a pretty safe bet.
So functional, as Senator Scalos says, Albany politics now is, Greg. It's still the eternal three men in a room cutting deals that everyone else has to live with?
Well, you know, in a way, I don't think it was three men in a room. It was one man in a room. This is Andrew Cuomo's budget, as he originally proposed. Yes, there have been some tweaks. $270 million was restored. $270 million out of this budget is rather minor. It seems to me this is the first budget, and as long as I can remember, where the governor's proposal got so little change by the other two men in the room.
Healthcare, Greg. The hospitals, the healthcare workers, and industry groups signed on to the governor's Medicaid redesign proposal last month, despite the deep cuts it recommended. And the reporting was that they were expecting, something in return, as the governor endorsed a cap on malpractice awards. But the cap is not in the budget. Did New York's entire healthcare industry get rolled?
Well, they lost something they really wanted, which was a cap on pain and suffering damages, but they did get a state-run fund to reimburse infant cases, with no fault being the prevailing concept there. That's a major step forward in malpractice reform. They also got what's going on in the health care cuts, which total a little more than $2 billion, is that there's a target of money that has to be saved, and the hospitals and other health care providers can save the money any way they want. And that's flexibility that they want. So did they get everything they wanted when they signed on to the deal? No. I think they probably knew it was risky, so I'm not sure that they feel betrayed. I think they probably felt it would have been nice to get more, but they did get something.
Liz, what would you add to that? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what I've been told, look, I was at the Capitol yesterday for this Red Room press conference, and we should really caution people, the details are not entirely hammered out. It's not soup yet. There are no bills, and we won't be seeing them until tomorrow. And there are conference committees meeting throughout the day in which some of these details are going to be reached, and we assume. So there's still room for everything to fall apart. I don't expect that it probably will. However, on the healthcare front, regarding the Med-Mal cap, it's been suggested to me by some folks, close to Cuomo, that that was actually a negotiating point and something that they weren't really seeking. What they really wanted was the fund, the indemnity fund for the neurologically impaired infants, which is something mm-hmm. that you just brought up. The governor himself, when I asked this question in the Red Room, because as you noted, the Medicaid redesign plan is something of a stool. There were pieces in there to buy off the Greater New York Hospital Association, and then another piece, the living wage, which is in the budget, that was to help 1199. So the question remains, would it all fall apart? And he said no. The bulk of the savings that's going to offset the cuts that the hospital industry voluntarily agreed to will be felt through the indemnity fund. That's what the governor mm-hmm. said last night in the Red Room.
What's the living wage provision?
Well, the living wage provision is going to mandate that healthcare workers, home health workers, receive a quote-unquote living wage. And, this is something that the industry is freaking out about because we've seen the fight in New York City. It was actually what killed the Kingsbridge Project. I mean, the idea that you would have to mandate to private industry that they would pay some kind of threshold that's above the minimum wage that is a living wage for workers.
I think, though, that it's important to note this is not the private sector. Home health care workers are fully funded by the state government and the local governments. So it isn't as controversial as Kingsbridge because it's not mandating private companies do this. It's mandating nonprofits who subsist entirely on government money doing it.
But
the details are a little unclear about how it'll work.
True, however, I mean, it is. I agree with you, David. Greg, I think that the point is that the issue is that the government doesn't often say, and you will spend, there is a minimum wage, which is, what everybody is minimally expected to be paid. But it's unusual for government to say, and you will pay more than that industry, you little piece of the industry, and not everyone in the whole state.
Liz Benjamin, Greg David, two people, four first names, as we talk about the New York State budget deal between the governor, the state Senate Majority Leader, and the Assembly Speaker yesterday. We can take some phone calls for them, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we still are, as Liz just said, getting details. Not all of this even completely hammered out. There are still some unresolved things. Like, for example, Greg, I understand still unresolved Governor Cuomo's property tax cap, not in this budget.
Yes, and let's enumerate what's not in the budget. Extension of New York City's rent regulation bills are not in the budget. The property tax cap is not in the budget. Ethics reform is pending, could have been done in conjunction with the budget. Mm-hmm. A nonpartisan redistricting pending could have been done as part of the budget. And it seems to me that that's a very important thing because this is where the budget is where the governor had the most leverage. And he will have less leverage in the coming months on all these other very important issues.
Yeah, well, there are two things about that, if I may, mm-hmm. Brian, if you don't mind. I think, first of all, the governor himself addressed this issue, and I think that he's been a little squishy on this particular topic. Again, last night asked whether he thought there would be people who would be voting no, for example, in protest of the failure to include the rent control issue in the budget. He said very strongly, well, you know, the budget is to do the budget and not to do other things. On the flip side, he also said previously to that that he wanted both rent control and the property tax cap in the budget. Now, today there's a piece in New York Magazine that I think is really interesting by Chris Smith, and it's a good read, that suggests that perhaps the governor, you know, larded up the budget with these ancillary issues to quote-unquote keep lawmakers busy so they didn't have the ability to fight as hard as they might have on cuts. So it could be considered a strategy to be, you know, clouding the water a little bit with issues and then in the end not include those issues. And let's be clear, the guy's very strong. I mean, if you look at the Siena New York poll this morning, his numbers are down slightly, but he is still well over that 50% mark, and the legislature's in the toilet.
Cuomo, he's proven himself to be politically very powerful right out of the gate. He's already surpassed Spitzer and Patterson in getting his way with the legislature. How did he do it, Liz?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, he was very deft in doing it. He of course, came in with a very strong mandate. He was elected not with a historic mandate, but pretty darn close. And he really sailed into office without a lot of anything, basically. I mean, you know, Carl Palladino was not a real – no, he was certainly a real opponent, but no one took him seriously in terms of being able to run the government, right? So he sails in. That's the first thing. He actually has knowledge of Albany. That's the second thing. I mean, you know, Elliot Spitzer had knowledge of Albany through the AG's office. So did Andrew Cuomo, but he also had knowledge of Albany through his father's administration, and he had seen what budget negotiations looked like. He was very deft at scaring the living daylights out of the legislature, but what really he had was he had the budget extender option, which is David Patterson's legacy, and that I don't see going forward changing, and the legislature has got to deal with it, because otherwise they're nothing but a rubber stamp.
Let's take a phone call. Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm just concerned. I mean, actually, to tell you the truth, I've lost all faith in Governor Cuomo after this budget. I really don't understand the justification for removing a surtax that was already in existence from the very wealthy New Yorkers and putting the total burden on the most disenfranchised New Yorkers and the weakest, you know, earners. I just don't understand that strategy.
Greg David?
Well, the answer to that is very simple. New York has the highest state and local tax burden in the nation. It is a stifling burden, especially on the upstate economy. And as the governor said a million times since he began running for reelection, the state's tax burden and regulatory climate is stifling the private sector. The government can't revive the economy. And as he said again last week, if we keep these high taxes on the wealthy, many of them will leave, and many will take their businesses with them.
Do you take it at face value? We had Ed Koch on the program last week who supported extending the millionaire's tax, and he said they're not all going to go and live in Florida or somewhere. They want to be in New York.
Well, look, there's, you know, that's one of the most controversial questions out there. But there's no doubt, I think, that high taxes do make a difference. And this is just, you know, I think you got to look beyond this. This is just the first step. Cuomo just wasn't about, Cuomo's program is not just about not extending the millionaire's tax. It is over the long term reducing taxes in New York. Whether he'll be able to do that or not, I don't know. One other point, you know, a lot of it is focused on education cuts. Education is not very good in New York, but it's not because we don't spend money. We spend more money than anyone else. And I think the question and what a lot of people are suggesting is it's not that we don't spend enough money. It's that we don't have the right systems in place to make education better.
Diane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diane.
Yeah, hi. You alluded to some changes in the rent control situation. Could you go into a little bit more detail about that?
Well, There aren't any. That's the thing. I mean, the rent laws are set to expire on June 15, and there was a push by a number of people to get them into the budget, negotiated their extension and their strengthening, which was the key, negotiated as part of the budget deal. That did not work in the end. And so the question is whether or not those forces have lost leverage, because the budget is, let's face it, you know, when you have your strongest position, because you can hold out on your yes votes.
But so as to not scare Diane or anyone else, you don't expect anybody who's currently living in a rent-stabilized apartment to lose that status, do you?
Well, you know, there's an interesting little squip today in Fred Dicker's column in the Post, which suggests that the Senate Republicans are going to will be willing to sacrifice the property tax cap to prevent the strengthening of the rent laws. Now, in terms of whether or not they will go on existing, I can't imagine that they will not go on existing. I mean, there would be like a near, you know, insurrection over it. But
right.
in terms
but,
of them being strengthened, no, I don't think so.
And the main goal of those who want to strengthen it is to end what they call vacancy decontrol, so it wouldn't be as easier to take a rent-stabilized apartment when a tenant moves out and convert it to market rates?
I think that's one of the things. I mean, I think that the issue also is that advocates felt and lawmakers who for whom this is important, largely New York City, although also there are some in the New York City suburbs as well, apartments that fall into this category, felt that the last time around, you know, they lost a lot. They lost a lot of in terms of the I know and I know Greg probably will be able to speak to this also. I mean, they lost in terms of the weakening, and they feel like they might as well this year.
That was back in the 90s, Greg?
Right.
Well, there's no doubt that, I, you know, remember Cuomo changed his position. On a Thursday, he was going to put it in the budget. On Monday, he wasn't. And I think that something must have happened in the background, because it's clear that the pro-regulation forces have lost, period, because now the Republican majority in the state Senate, which, by the way, is a majority only because of the money they got from the real estate interests, will hold the veto power. And the person who's always willing to let the rent-regulated laws expire is the one that's in the driver's seat. So I don't think we're going to see any strengthening of rent laws. Now, the real estate interests have two objectives in this upcoming fight. One is not to allow the threshold for luxury decontrol to rise. The other is to get a reversal of this famous decision which resulted in such trouble at Peter Cooper in Stuytown, which is a technical one, but if you take this J51 benefits, you can't deregulate any apartments. And I think that's where the oomph is going to come. No one expects the laws not to be renewed, but I agree with Liz, there's no way they're going to be strengthened.
We have a few minutes left with Liz Benjamin from the Daily News and YNN and Greg David from Cranes and the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. I want to get back to Medicaid for just a minute. With all these cuts to health care and the various trade-offs that you were both talking about before, Greg, if I'm a poor person dependent on Medicaid for my health care, am I going to get less health care?
No, I don't really think so. 75% of the dollars that are spent in Medicaid are spent on 25% of the people. And we can do a better job doing it. Remember, we spend an enormous amount more than states like California do on Medicaid. Now, there is an area of optional services which over time will come under scrutiny. But at the moment, saving $2 billion on the program is going to be done through providers being more efficient. It's also going to be done, and maybe this is what you mean by is your health care going to change, we are going to move many more people on Medicaid into managed care. Mm-hmm. So there may be fewer options. That does not translate necessarily into less care.
Any difference on that, Liz?
No, I mean, I think a lot of this also stand. We have a lot of changes coming down the pike with the health care reform law. There's going to be a lot of sort of remains to be seen situations here. The one thing worth mentioning, though, is that this agreement gives an enormous amount of power to the health commissioner, Nirav Shah, who specializes in getting systems, health systems, to run in a more efficient way. I believe that's why the governor chose him.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, this gives him the ability that if hospitals don't reach the voluntary, cut themselves threshold of 4%, to go in and do it for them. So I think that they really did give something up there. And that, again, the idea that they were going to save in the long term on their incredibly expensive insurance bills is why the indemnity fund was created.
But, Liz, if I'm a poor child in a public school in New York State, then I probably am going to feel some pain here, right?
I suspect so. I don't know what that's going to look like, and I think that it really remains to be seen. I don't know exactly how it will impact individual people.
Greg?
Brian, I just disagree with that. There's so much enormous dysfunction in our Medicaid system. It shouldn't work that way. Just the way the education cuts should not mean worse education in New York. If there's anything we've learned over and over again is we do a terrible job on Medicaid and we do a terrible job on education, despite spending more money than any other state in the country.
Greg, I'm sorry. I got to beg to differ with that. If you are following the headlines all over New York State right now, you will see that that various different school districts, particularly those upstate, are laying off teachers and they're cutting programs. That's just the bottom line. That's the reality of what districts are doing. Now, why they're doing it or whether they can cut the 2.7 average that Cuomo says is going to happen here in the reduction in aid, whether they have enough in reserves, if superintendents should cap their salaries, et cetera, that all may be. But the reality is that if you look at the headlines, districts are cutting back.
And Mayor Bloomberg is not happy with the way this budget deal went down. Do we now say with certainty that the mayor really is going to lay off 4,600 teachers, as he's been threatening, if Albany didn't come through with a better budget? Greg?
If he lays off 4,600, he's not going to lay off 4,600 teachers. That was his negotiating position, both for the budget and in order to get the changes in the seniority rule. You know, a year ago, he threatened to lay off 15,000 teachers, and I don't think we laid anybody off. We lost some jobs from attrition. Are there going to be some reductions in teacher jobs? Probably. I'll be really shocked if we lay off more than 4,000 teachers.
Liz, a last word on teacher layoffs, and it's unresolved still what New York City gets compared to suburban school districts. They still have to hash that out, right?
Yeah, look, we also haven't seen $270 million, as Greg said, is not a lot of money, and I agree, and vis-a-vis the $1.5 billion that Cuomo wanted to cut from education. But we haven't seen the details of who gets what in terms of restoration yet. So let's wait and see how much the city's going to get, although the city and the Bloomberg administration are at odds about how much they may or may not have in reserve to cover this themselves. So I think that's a little bit of a stay-tuned situation. The mayor has threatened teacher layoffs before and pulled back at the 11th hour because of getting additional aid. So I don't know what's going to happen in this instance.
Liz Benjamin, Daily News columnist and statewide political show host on YNN in Albany. What? No?
No longer Daily News columnist.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were still in
okay.
there from time to time. Sorry about that. Where can people see your blog?
They can go to Capital Tonight and click on State of Politics.
All right. And Greg David, Crane's New York business columnist. You're still doing that, right?
And I'm still doing that. And by the way, Liz Blogs is so good, I'm on it at least four times a day.
Oh, that's nice.
And
thanks.
Greg is the director of the Business and Economics Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will compare humanitarian imperatives. Shoot your way into Libya to protect civilians, but not into Ivory Coast. We'll look at the situation in the Ivory Coast and why that keeps coming up. Stay tuned.